For this next session, it's my pleasure to introduce Alan Beeman, who's going to talk about Generation Fuel Mix, which is something very near and dear to our hearts here in the state of Florida these days, especially in light of recent events in the natural gas markets that Don was explaining. And it's our pleasure to have Alan Beeman here from the Energy Information Administration. He's the director of the Coal and Electric Power Division in EIA's Office of Integrated Analysis and Forecasting, and has been working on these electricity analysis and projects since 1984, so with over 20 years of experience working with EIA. And I think as you saw from Don's presentation, the Energy Information Administration is sort of seen as the authority without a dog in the hunt, if you wish, on all matters related to energy in terms of what price forecasts, what the market may look like going forward into the future. And we saw that with Don's presentation. Fortunately, there won't be terribly much overlap, as Alan will be talking more about coal issues rather than natural gas. Alan at EIA, his responsibilities include the development and maintenance of the coal, renewable energy, and electricity components of the National Energy Modeling System, which is used to come up with a lot of the forecasts and trends that we see in the annual energy outlook each year. The outlook currently runs through 2030, looking at energy consumption and prices. It's also used to prepare special studies, such as those requested by Congress or the administration, including the development of the SO2 allowance database under the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, as well as recent analyses of various pieces of legislation on environment, including the Carper Bill, McCain-Lieberman, and the Clear Skies Initiative from the administration. Alan received his bachelor's degree in economics from the College of William and Mary, and without further ado, I will bring Alan up here and let him go on about coal-fired generation, among other things.
Among other things. I'm going to talk about a lot of things. I guarantee you I won't, you know, as I told Paul, I don't have a single Inga slide. So you won't see any of the ones that he showed earlier. I didn't use any of those in my presentation from EIA, so you won't be any duplication in that respect. I appreciate coming here today. I'm going to talk a lot about the things driving the generation fuel mix, and a lot of the questions that came up earlier, it really leads in well, because I'm going to talk about uncertainty in some of these the future. Some of this will probably be a little elementary to people who have been in this business, but I want to talk about some of, you know, how all this plays together and what drives them. First thing, just to for those of you who don't know much about EIA, we are the independent statistical agency within the Department of Energy. When people who don't know what that is, you know, I always explain it by saying we're sort of the energy equivalent of the Bureau of Labor Statistics over at BLS. Actually, I came from BLS, so I can speak to both of those. We're policy independent. We don't advocate policies. We don't develop policies. But we're often asked to evaluate them. A great deal of my work is at being asked by particular senators, congressmen, or the administration to run scenarios or sort of what ifs. What if the McCain-Lieberman bill passes? What if the Carper bill passes? What if the policy recommendations of the National Commission on Energy Policy passes or is enacted? We've run renewable portfolio standards, national RPS cases. A whole host of different scenarios, and I think a lot of the things that you talk about, we've run restricted natural gas supply analysis, where we've said, what if you can't, they just don't build the LNG, nothing comes in except for the ones that are under construction, all of those. And all of those are on these links that I've provided here. The first link is just to our main web page. The second three link you to our various forecasting products, the short-term energy outlook, and the annual energy outlook, and the international energy outlook. And then these ones, the last two are ones to all of these various studies that we've done. And a lot of these, I think, would get at questions and the impacts of some of these what-ifs if they do occur. Again, to emphasize the point, we are independent. Frequently, Department of Energy, when they don't like what we say, they don't say anything about it. When they do, they say EIA supports us. So. It varies from time to time. A couple things I want to make, and I'm going to say this over and over again, energy markets are uncertain. Everybody focuses on our reference case, including us, which is probably a mistake. But in the AEO, there are over 35 different cases. We have high and low economic growth cases. We have alternative oil and gas cases, alternate coal price cases. We have dozens of technology cases where we look at things like different assumptions about the costs of, and performance of new technologies, fossil, renewable, nuclear. We have several regulatory sensitivity cases where we look at things like the new CAFE and things that are under proposal. Across these cases, you can see that the world oil price in 2030 varies from $28 to $90 against in the different cases. The gas price varies from about $5 to almost $8. And so there's an enormous amount of range in this, and I would encourage people to look at this. It scares me because I think people realize there's uncertainty, but yet when everybody calls on the phone, they ask, what's the price of gas in 2030? And you sort of mumble because you don't really want to say. And then they and you get where you give them a range, and they say, no, I don't want that. What's the price? You say, well, about $5, $6. Well, how many cents? And you're like, oh, come on. And you get a little bit nervous about that. It really scares me when I do get calls from people who are saying that they're some from some law firm or investment firm, and they're doing due diligence on somebody's investment in a power plant or something. I rush really quickly to make sure I don't have any investments in those companies. They scare me. Look at my mutual funds. You don't own any of that, do you? Make sure, because it's a little bit frightening. But they do it. Some big changes in this year's AEO. We did extend the model to 2030. There's a big sections in this year's AEO. I'm not going to talk about it too much. About a bunch of technologies that are sort of, we don't think are going to play a big role between now and 2030. They're on the horizon, but if they're successfully developed towards the end of the horizon, you could see they might have a big impact. And a lot of those are discussed in a major article in the front of the report, and I'd suggest people looking at that because they could have a big impact. We also incorporated the Clean Air Interstate Rule for SOx and NOx reductions, the Cleaner Mercury Rule, and we do represent EPACT to the degree that there are explicit standards or tax incentives in the bill. We don't represent there's an awful lot of provisions in EPAC that will require future appropriations. And if anyone who has been around Washington enough knows that many, many things that are authorized never get appropriated, and many, many things that are appropriated were never authorized. We don't take a position on those because we don't know what they're going to do with them. But with regard in the EPAC, in the power sector, there are incentives for nuclear. There are tax extended credits for renewables. There are clean coal incentives, and on the demand side, in the residential commercial sectors, there are energy efficiency standards for a whole host of appliances, and all of those do affect power forecasts. Another issue is that we do have higher world oil prices this year. Last year we were reaching prices in the $35 range. Now we're talking $57 in 2030, about $20 higher. We are not in the group that believes we are approaching peak oil, but we do believe that we were probably too optimistic about development and how much investment would go in, especially into the Middle East and expanding their output. So we've cut that back this year, and we end up with those significantly higher prices. Our natural gas prices are also higher. As Don Santa talked about earlier, LNG is a really difficult issue to deal with because it's a world market. We're concerned about this relationship between oil and gas prices, that if oil prices are significantly high, there are lots of parts of the world that use a lot more oil in their generation sector than we do. Well, they'd have an enormous incentive to try to buy that gas that we might otherwise import to switch out of oil. There's also the potential for going to gas to liquids production if the prices are high enough, and that would be another issue that would drive that market. So I'll talk about a little bit of that. We do have slower electricity demand growth, and most of that's driven by the efficiency standards and higher prices that we see in this year's forecast. All these should be familiar to everybody in here. What drives decisions? I don't think any of them are unique. Demand growth and load characteristics. I'm going to show a few slides on that in a few minutes, so I won't talk about that too much. The existing technology mix. This is a big issue, and this was a big issue in the 1990s. I've heard over and over again that people built gas plants in the last wave that we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years because they couldn't site coal plants, they couldn't get anything else built. But I want to bring up one big issue: is they didn't need baseload capacity. In 1990, coal plants' capacity factor was 59%. Nuclear plants' capacity factor was 66%. They had a lot of plants that weren't running. There were many regions of the country where if you added their coal and nuclear capacity together, that was 85% of their capacity. And when you only have most regions have something on the order of a 60% load factor, that just doesn't make sense. The previous wave was very heavily base load oriented, and they ended up with a really odd mix of capacity. And it was nice that also you had low gas prices during that period, and you had these new turbines and combined cycle plants that came along in the early to mid-90s, because that made it make sense. But I suspect, had even the gas prices been somewhat higher, you still would have been mostly gas turbine and combined cycle oriented, because it just made sense. New technology, cost, and performance. Of course, those are big issues. There's a couple technologies now that people are talking about a lot that, until they're really built, nobody's going to really know what they cost. We can all guess. There's a new generation of nuclear plants. The vendors have argued that these plants are simpler. They involve a lot less piping and other air things that they've done to them to make them less expensive. But today, none of them have been built. There hasn't been one ordered in the United States in 30 years, hasn't been one completed in 10, so you really don't know what they're going to cost. And so there's a big uncertainty there. There's a lot of talk in the coal area about IGCC. There's a couple sort of demonstration plants that were built as part of DOE's programs of decades. There's one here in Florida. Polk is in Florida. But those were small. Their costs were pretty high. Can they scale those up and drive the cost down and make them more competitive? That's a big issue. Fuel cells. The DOE has a program with fuel cells. They want fuel cells today are extremely expensive. 10 times what you would pay for a combustion turbine or a combined cycle. But DOE's program is to cut those programs by a factor of 10 in 10 or 15 years. If they can do that, that's a real challenge. Of course, fuel prices are a big issue, and there's an enormous amount of uncertainty. And I'm going to talk about that a lot. Interest rates and cost of capital. I would link the interest rates and cost of capital a lot to the changing regulatory structure. Years ago, the developers of power plants, I would say today, almost everywhere, they face a lot more risk than they faced, maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Everybody knows the term IPP. Before IPPs, it was EWG. When the exempt wholesale generators came about as the Energy Policy Act of 1992, there were people financing power plants, and they were financing these things with 70-80% debt, because they could go to a utility and get a long-term contract, then go to the bank and say, I've sold this, and I've got this long-term contract for 30 years, and they could get enormously good financing. But that's not happening anymore. People aren't saying you can't get contracts for 20 or 30 years anymore. So that's really affecting the financing of power plants. Tax policies and other policy incentives. You have the renewable production tax credit. You're now in EPAC. You have a production tax credit for the first 6,000 megawatts of new nuclear plants. You have various tax incentives. You have some tax credits for clean coal plants. All of those things are significant issues. In the states, a whole host of states have 20-something states now, I can hardly keep up with it, have various renewable incentive programs. So all of those things are affecting it. And of course, environmental regulations. We have, as I mentioned before, we have the Clean Air Interstate Rule, CAMR, but there's ongoing debate about the next set of standards and ratcheting them down even further. There's also ongoing debate about various bills for greenhouse gas emission reductions. Senator Carper is talking about reintroducing his bill. McCain and Lieberman may reintroduce their bill. Whether those things are going anywhere, nobody knows. But I don't think environmental concerns are going to lessen in any way over the next 10 or 20 years. This is showing the relationship between electricity sales growth and demand growth and economic growth. I mean, if you since the 50s, as you can see, you know, there was a time when electricity demand growth was. They've always grown together. They've always looked somewhat like mirror images of one another, except electricity was growing much more rapidly until about the mid 70s. Then it from the mid 70s to the mid 80s, it was almost 1-to-1, and then since then, relative to economic growth, you've seen a slowdown in electricity growth. Now, part of this, there's a whole host of things going on here. Early on, penetration of all those electric appliances that we now basically take for granted. You talk to kids today and they can't even imagine a world without microwaves and cell phones or CDs, and wouldn't even recognize an LP if you showed it to them with all these technologies. But that sort of has run its course. I don't think you're going to be adding air conditioners to houses in Vermont, but perhaps it might happen. Also, appliances have got a lot more efficient. You've also had big changes in the underlying industrial structure. But what we see going out into the future is that trend is going to continue. You're going to see sales are going to continue to grow with economic growth, but at a much slower rate. Our average sales growth rate is about 1.6% through 2030. And some of these I think are really elementary, but one of the issue I wanted to make a point is we get called all the time and people ask us, you know, why do they build gas plants or why do they build this? Because they don't understand that you build a mix of capacity. That capacity doesn't all meet the same, you know, load. And then one thing that in the power sector, you have this strange dichotomy of plants that are really expensive to build but load cheap to run, and plants that are cheap to build but expensive to run. And that really affects all the mix. And this illustrates some of these points that demand goes up and down. A lot of plants are not going to be running. Even on the this was PJM data in 2005. And even on the lowest cost day, you can see that from the low demand period to the high demand period, demand is increasing 50%, even on the lowest day. And then between the lowest day and the peak on their peak day, demand is three times as big as it is. And that makes a huge difference. A lot of capacity isn't running, so you don't want to build coal plants to run to serve peak load or nuke plants. Some people did it back in the 80s, and they're not around anymore. But this is just the load duration curve and the point that about 40% of your capacity on average isn't running. So you want to build plants that get dead. You build some plants to run infrequently, and you build other plants to run almost full out, and that has a big impact. And, you know, the load characteristics have a huge impact on capacity selection. This is our assumptions for the overnight cost of various types of power plants. You know, from the low end, the turbines in the $350 or so dollar per kilowatt range to the PVs in the $4,500 kilowatt range. They vary all over the place. If you look at as I mentioned, there's uncertainty about all of these, and they vary from place to place, so you can't generalize entirely, but there's quite a mix. We represent all of these technologies. Actually, we represent more, but I don't want to cloud the slide even more.
Hey, Al, what does that mean, overnight?
Overnight is the cost of building without any financing cost. In other words, it's if you could just build it overnight without the financing cost, that's what it would cost you.
Okay.
These are our delivered fuel prices. As Don talked earlier and showed in a few slides, we do expect prices to moderate off the levels that they are today. But I'm going to talk about some cases where they don't, so that you can see the impacts of what that might mean. We expect gas prices to fall and then recover, delivered to the power sectors, to end up being in the above $6 range by 2030. Bottoming out in the 450 to 460 range. Coal we expect to deliver to the power sector in the $1.30 to $1.50 range by 2030. And then this is a levelized cost chart, and again, a lot of you are probably pretty familiar with this. It's sort of distorted because when you put PV on with anything else, PV or fuel cells, it sort of compresses everybody else. But if you look closely, you can see that the competitive technologies tend to be the coal, combined cycle, and turbine technologies for different things. One caution with this is, you know, fuel levelized costs aren't everything yet, though, particularly for technologies like wind and solar that are intermittent. They tend to operate a lot as in some markets as fuel savers, so they're looking at their levelized cost doesn't really provide you the information you need. And then this is, again, when I try to explain to people why you want to build a mix of capacity, this is a little screening tool that a lot of people have seen. And I only put three technologies on here just because it's overwhelming if you have a whole pile. But it shows you the combustion turbine technologies has, you know, still is the dominant. If you only want capacity to run fairly infrequently, it is the most economical choice. Combined cycles in the middle. What's really happening here with the gas prices is these points are moving around. As gas prices get higher, this point is going to move because this line is going to get a lot steeper, and this line, this crossover point, is going to move further and further to the left, and that makes it, you know, much more sense to move back towards coal. So what does all this mean? This is Don had a similar chart, but this is capacity additions for every year from 1950 through 2030 in our projections. And unless you've been, I guess, out of the country for the last 6 or 7 years, you realize that there's been an enormous building boom about between 1999 and 2005. I think it was on the order of 230,000 megawatts of capacity. Something on the order of 95% of that was natural gas fired. So it was an enormous amount of capacity has been added. But I'd point out a couple things. We did this before.
On what percentage of that was independent power producers?
I would suspect the vast majority of it was. And the vast majority of it was independents. It was not all that much built by utilities. But the point I'd make is we've done this before. We in the 90s, we were basically building off a boom that took as many years to get. Go ahead, you had a question?
No, I was going
to
say,
I can get that for you. Off the top of my head, I think it's a little more combined cycle than turbines. I think it's like 60-40 or something like that. But that's
still
just
a lot of peaking capacity.
It is a lot of peaking capacity, but it's still, if it's 60% combined cycle, the average capacity factor for all of this new capacity has been adding is a little under 20%. They're not running very much. A lot of people I saw a lot of articles when all this building boom was going on, and people were taking the amount of capacity built and then applying assumed capacity factors and saying, demand for gas is going to go through the roof. And that would have been true if they ran them. But you can't. There just wasn't enough demand to run them all. The price of coal gas wasn't low enough to displace the coal that was already out there. So you ended up not running them very much. And a lot of times where you did run them, you knocked off old oil and gas steam plants that were even a lot less efficient. So there's been a huge, if you look at the average natural, just the country's average natural gas heat rate in the last 15 years, it's dropped like 15 to 16% just because of this influx of more efficient capacity and the retirement of older ones. Another thing I think people are surprised about is between 1990 and 2005, coal generation actually increased more than gas generation. But it was at existing plants. They were, those guys are operating at 59% in 1990. Now they're operating a lot more. They're in the low 70s. The nuclear plants are in the 90% range. So they just didn't need the coal, and they moved to building all the gas and others. Now, when we see the new building start, we see a pretty drought period here in terms of the new additions. And when we see the mix coming back and building ramping back up, we're seeing it much more coal dominated, and we see that mix. Now, I know some people in the earlier session mentioned, well, how are they going to site this coal? How are they going to build it? A few years ago, we've all, in our projections for the last 5 or 6 years, we've been projecting at some point in the outer years they're going to build new coal because they would need baseload, and people would just laugh and say they'll never build a new coal plant, and everybody seems to be fairly short run focused. On our surveys now, we collect only for the next 3 or 4 years, ask people what they're building. There's right now, there's 18,000 megawatts of coal being reported. fairly far along projects. I've seen lists now of 60 to 100,000 megawatts of coal in various stages of development. There are parts of the country where it's not that hard to build coal. There are, of course, parts where it's hard to build just about anything. So I suspect when you see the money that's involved, you can do an awful lot to spur these projects along. I agree with one comment I heard in the earlier session that people are going to need to do a lot of public relations. They're not going to need to sell these projects and work on them. That's going to be a big part. I've also heard people say it's hard to finance. Even though those plants were gas plants that they built, that 230,000 megawatts, that still means that they came up with somewhere between $100 and $150 billion to build all those plants. So they can, if you have to, and you can go to a banker, you can get the money.
Alan, what's the choice of coal technology going forward?
It's a combination.
IGCC?
Early years, it's dominated by pulverized coal. With all of the various, we don't assume a turning point. It turns because coal prices, as the emissions allowance prices get higher, and because coal prices get higher, and at some point the higher coal price makes the efficiency advantage of the IGCC worth it to switch from the PC to the IGCC. It varies, and some we get some early builds because of the EPAC. EPAC has 3 gigawatts of incentives for new IGCC. I think we get some of them in the 2010-12 range, but I would say probably on the order of 2/3 of the builds in the first 10 or 15 years are PC, and it switches to 2/3 the other way by the end. So it does move in that direction. We'll see that. You'll see that in a little bit.
Okay.
Won't look like that. This is just the fuel mix.
My next question.
and you see that gas, the interesting thing, our gas share does grow. Today it's about 18%. We have it growing through around the 2020 time frame. It hits a peak of around 22% of the market. And then it starts to tail off and ends up at by 2030 right around 17, where not too far where it is today. Incidentally, for people that don't remember, gas was 24% back in the mid 80s, so it was higher at one time. We have coal today about 50%. It tails off as all of these gas plants that have been built, their production ramps up over the next 5 to 10 years, falls to somewhere around 49%. And by the end, it's 55 to 57% of the market. One thing that's interesting, I looked back, because I made this slide back to 1950, I looked at the shares, and coal's never been under 46% in all that time. It's basically hovered between 46 and 50% for that entire time, even with everything else that moved. And, even with all the nuclear that was built in certain periods, it was always in that. I was surprised by that. We do see at the top, you see growth in non-hydro renewables. Part of that because of the tax incentives, part of it because of the various state programs. But we have the shares now is about 2%, grows to a little like 4.5% of the generation market. One thing I hear a lot, people thinking that higher gas prices really will spur a lot more non-hydro renewable wind, solar, biomass. But what we find is because these fuels, particularly wind, is a fuel saver in some of the off-peak hours, it really depends on what your fuel mix is. If your gas prices are really high, and that spurs a penetration of a lot of additional coal-fired capacity, and those coal guys are setting the shoulder prices, then the wind doesn't look too attractive, and so you don't get as much as you might otherwise get. So as long as you can build, if you can build coal, then it does, high gas prices don't necessarily spur a lot of renewables. This is the just to illustrate the impact of CAMR and CARE. People I talked to at EPA when they decided they're going to rename every single rule they have as clean air and then something. I was threatening I'd give them a We Care T-shirts, but.
They didn't like that very much.
That was a rule when the new administrator, he's since left. That was he was only there for a short time and went over to HHS, but he wanted every rule named, starting with clean air. But you see a huge reductions in SO2 and NOx. We see this coming about primarily by the retrofitting of control equipment, scrubbers for SO2 and SCRs for NOx. You know, this, another issue I've heard is people saying that coal, you know, that you'd see a lot of coal retirements if you, because of environmental rules. I looked back, you know, 1990 to 2005, I thought I'd look and see if there were any retirements because we had the SO2 program and all that. There were about, in that entire time frame, there were about 5,000 megawatts of coal retired. There was only one of them that was over 200 megawatts. So what you're seeing is these little coal plants that it's very, you know, that there's a real scale economy to retrofitting. They don't want to do it. And I've even heard the one bigger one, they're maybe talking about bringing it back. But this is also during a time when gas was costing less than $3, and yet they still weren't retiring coal plants. Most of them were retrofitting. One way to think about this whole issue is that let's suppose you have to add a scrubber and an SCR to one of your larger coal plants. That means to keep running that plant, you're going to be spending $300 or $400 a kilowatt. That's still a pretty cheap plant. That uses a fuel that's $1, $1.25, $1.50 makes a lot of sense. Same thing for mercury. We see mercury emissions dropping quite a bit. We don't see it if you look at the rules. We don't see it hitting the targets because there's early banking and it's still running off the bank, so it doesn't quite hit the 15-ton cap even by 2030. But it's getting pretty close. I don't know how many of you have followed the endless technology stuff they're doing with mercury, but some of them, we did run a case in our in the AEO. There was a side case where we looked at some of the promising technologies with these new types of activated carbon injection systems that are looking awfully promising and pretty inexpensive. People were worried a few years ago that you couldn't clean subbituminous or lignite coals and that was really going to make them problematic, but those technologies are starting to look like that won't it be anywhere near that case. One thing that doesn't go down, if you, you know, continued use of natural gas, continued use of coal, power sector CO2 emissions go up about 40% in that time frame. So that is still an issue, and it's still moving in the direction. We do not, you know, we assume existing rules and regulations, so we don't have any assumed program to reduce greenhouse gases in here. Electricity prices. Now again, we expect to see the same sort of moderation with prices falling, rising a little higher than they to about 7.5 cents by 2030. But all this is tied to those fuel price assumptions. So what I'm going to talk about is, again, uncertainty. All forecasts are wrong. You know, as I tell people, the only thing that differs is how often you publish them. You know, I'm only glad that we only do it once a year. We have a short-term energy guys who do it every month, and I feel sorry for them. You know, we don't have to do it that often. And why might we be wrong? You could have a lot more improvement in various generating technologies. Those things tend to go slowly, though, in their acceptance into the market, but they could affect the longer-term results. If our fuel costs are wrong, environmental regulations or policies, if they are enacted, we could be off quite a bit. Changes in consumer preferences, you know, maybe people will really decide that they want to buy hybrids or whatever and they'll go crazy. We have significant growth in our transportation sector for hybrid and diesel-powered cars. They're both selling well over 1 million cars a year by 2030. Now, when I say hybrids, we're talking about what we call the full hybrids, not the where they put the hybrids like in the Highlander and some of these other guys where they really don't affect fuel. They're performance hybrids. We're talking about the hybrids for fuel economy. But as I pointed out before, there's an awful lot of sensitivity cases in the AEO, and I always try to encourage people to look at a wide array. When people call me and they're looking at some investment in some new power plant, I'm always saying, well, you might want to look at you know, how it shakes out if you assume different assumptions, how robust is it? And so I'm just going to talk about a few of these cases. We have the low oil and gas cases. In the low case, the gas price in 2030 is under $5, and in the high, it's right around $8. So we have quite an array there, low coal and high coal price cases. In those cases, if you look back over the coal industry for the last 20 or 30 years, there's been enormous productivity improvements. In the last year, couple of years, it has slowed down, but I've heard arguments that that's due to they've had to ramp up. It's going to take a while to train all these new miners. This is the first time in many years they actually hired new miners. And it's going to take a while to bring those guys up to speed. They're also bringing in new equipment, and it's going to take a while, and then that productivity improve again. And then I've heard other people argue that, no, that it will never get back on that downward slope again because the reserves are overburden ratios are growing. You're not going to be able to do that again. So those things, that's what we tried to look at in these cases. And in those cases, we had in the low price case about $1 for coal per million BTU, and the high, it was on the order of I think it was $1.10 in the low and $2.20 in the high case. Nuclear cases. We looked at several different nuclear cost cases. In our reference case, we're assuming that the new nuclear plant coming online in 2015 would cost right around $1,900 a kilowatt. The vendors that are out there are arguing that they can build these new generation plants much lower cost than that. Some of them approaching half that, $1,100 a kilowatt. You know, until they're built, who knows? The ones that are being built around the world today, they're the older generation technology, but they still are taking advantage of the new construction processes and other things like that. The Japanese aren't, you know, building these things like they built them 30 years ago, and they're costing somewhere in the $2,000 to $2,500 per kilowatt range. So even our reference case assumptions are lower than that. We're assuming they're 10 or 15% lower, but that could have a big impact if they turn out to be right. If they build those plants, those first few plants, and they turn out to have costs in the $1,500 or less range, that's an awfully competitive technology. And not in the AEO, but we did a recent analysis where we assumed, what if this production tax credit that they keep extending 2 years at a time, they just instead, let's just extend it for 10 years. The two-year extensions really kill every technology but wind. You know, if you're a geothermal guy or a biomass guy and it takes you 3-4 years even to bring your plant on, 2 years doesn't do you any good. It's gone. The wind guys are the only one that's sort of been able to take advantage of this. So that's been there has been talk. We've been asked to do this before. So since we had done it, I put it in here just to talk about what does it mean. This is the interesting thing is what does it do to coal generation? Of course, as you might expect it, the span of coal is really actually driven by the high oil and gas and low oil and gas cases. If you get gas prices falling back down below $5 and they stay there, then you'll see a lot more use of combustion turbines and combined cycle plants. I think when a lot of these people built these combined cycle plants, they were thinking gas prices in the $3 range and thinking that at that price they're competitive even in base load. But they won't be with higher prices. But the one point I'd look at this and I say that coal's going up. Even across all these cases, it's going up. And it takes pretty significant changes to really move it around. One interesting thing here is the nuclear. If you see this, where you see it dropping off, the timing of nuclear is, most people don't believe you could build one no matter what by before 2015. So if nuclear does come on and does prove to be economic, where it would have an impact is in those last 5 or 10 years. It's not going to affect the next 15 or so. And look at gas. The interesting thing that I see here is that we're projecting basically on almost every case that you are going to have a ramp up in gas as those existing plants are used more than they are today. Most of them aren't running very much today. But then as the gas price rises, you're going to see a leveling off in most cases and even a decline. The only exception to that in these is if the gas price falls back down in the $5 or less range, which is in that low gas price case. You notice the nuclear doesn't do much to gas. Nuclear competes mostly with the coal, so you don't see much moving around with that. The PTC has a little bit of impact. It does bring gas gas down quite a bit in the early years, but not so much in the later years. So it would dampen, if you brought it on very quickly, it would dampen on that early years where gas is the marginal lot. And notice the time frame. It really doesn't do anything until the later years. The nuclear vendor case, that case shows 77,000 megawatts of new nuclear by 2030. So not quite, but getting approaching doubling what we have today, about 75% more than we have today. That would have a significant impact. And then the renewables. The interesting thing, I remember I pointed this out before, that we didn't see gas prices really pushing it. You see two cases that really push renewables. One, they extend the PTC for 10 years. I mean, it's a very attractive subsidy for renewables, and it makes them very competitive. The other one is high coal prices. Because then you've got coal, if you've got $2 or $2.20 or $30 coal prices, then those shoulder hours, it makes a lot of sense. You know, the wind starts to really be a great fuel saver. But it doesn't, in the other cases, you don't see it driving it all that much. Let's see. And then electricity prices, of course, you notice that the gas prices, they do drive it up significantly. So do coal, and high coal prices. The coal prices mostly have an impact later. You see prices in the 8-cent range if you end up with much higher coal and gas prices. The other scenarios don't move it too much. I would encourage you to look at a wide variety of cases in the AO when you're looking at any sorts of investments. You know, these power plants are cost somewhere between $250 million and the billions of dollars. You know, I don't know it off the top of my head. I would say that's true. That it's been too low, and in previous years but it has been the other way in other years.
I'm trying to figure out. You know, when you look at these, and you say, okay, does there seem to be some sort of trend in under or over forecasting to say that?
You know, I'd have to go back and. I would have to go back and look. We do publish along with the AO every year. We do a comparison forecast looking at the actuals to all of our previous forecasts. We'll update that shortly this year. I think the gas, you know, gas and oil prices, I think, have been really the worst by far. But other areas, in terms of capacity additions and things like in generation, we've done fairly well. So
it varies. Fuel prices.
Yes. Yeah. They haven't been very good.
Because I
would encourage people to think about those things. My tendency would look at all the cases and see where it flips your decision. I mean, if it says it only makes it in the low gas case, on the other hand, if it says you have in the high gas price, that's the only way I can justify this investment, then you have to really think about it and look at those sorts of things. But I think that's a big issue. We do run, some people talked earlier about this problem with siting and permitting. I see this as like one of those carnival clowns who makes things out of balloons. You know, if you squeeze it somewhere, then, the other side comes out. And so if you say, you can't build gas, we're not going to let you have gas access. We're not going to let you build coal plants. If you do that, I can tell you what would happen to our model. The thing would start to build more gas, but then it would say, forget it, I'll build nuclear. Then you say, I'm not going to let you build all those new nuclear plants. Or then it'll try to build biomass and say that I want to site all those new, but the price will be going up significantly. We run cases like that all the time just to test the model. Say, all right, no new coal. We'll see what happens. Price is 20 or 30% higher, and you push things all over the place. You have to think about all those things have implications. And this is what you asked about greenhouse gases. We did not include this in the AEO,
we're very cautious about what sort of policy things we would include in our annual energy outlook because we are policy independent. And even if we thought that there's for certain some sort of policy was going to happen, if we put one, you know, there's a dozens of possible policies out there. If we included one in the AEO, we'd be implicitly supporting it, and we wouldn't have jobs anymore. So we don't do that. We want to stay neutral and be helpful to policymakers. And so we do it when asked. They asked us to examine, in case you're not familiar with the numbers, S-139 was McCain-Lieberman, which required the power sector to reduce its emissions in two phases, once back to the 2000 level and then a later phase out back to the 1990 level. And then S-2028 was actually a second part of that, where they threw out the second phase, said only come back to the 2000 level. But the point here is then we see coal essentially dropping off dramatically, being something along the quarter of what it is today. This study is a couple years old. It's not from our AEO, but it just sort of provides you what that might do. All of these studies are available on our website, and all the detailed results of them are available on our website.
Now, my next question, given that you chose the previous chart that showed that there was a switchover at some point between PC to IPCC, does that factor in that switchover?
Yes, it does. We do build.
Okay.
We do. Now, let's say one thing about this study. This is this.
With IGCC coming online, it's much larger volumes, even in 2025.
Well, I make one caution about this study was done 2-3 years ago. And in that time frame, our gas prices were quite a bit lower. So instead of going to maybe coal IGCC with carbon capture and sequestration, you'd go to gas. But with the gas prices we have now, that doesn't look like if you instituted some sort of greenhouse gas policy, instead of going from reduced coal to increased gas, instead you go from reduced coal to increased renewables and increased nuclear. And you don't see, and we do see coal with sequestration being built, but not enough to offset the reduction in the existing coal. So you do see them being built. We actually have another study in the works that will come out in a few days. I wrote it right before I came here, so it's in review, where we did a study. National Commission on Energy Policy had some proposal last year to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we were asked by Senator Salazar to look at alternatives to that. And it has much more, several cases that are much more stringent than what the NCEP actually proposed. And you will see impacts in that study that are show the trade-offs in the fuels.
Mm.
Well, we have both. We have done that. We did not do it in this study, but we have done that in other studies, and it is there. But we do assume that you could build new coal IGCC with carbon capture and sequestration. But where a new IGCC plant without that costs you something on the order of a little over $1,400, somewhere between $1,400 and $1,500 a kilowatt, that plant with the carbon capture and sequestration puts you somewhere around $1,900 to $2,000 a kilowatt. And you're removing only 90% of the carbon. A new nuclear plant, as I mentioned before, was only about $1,900 and had a lot lower fuel costs. So it tends to beat it out. So unless they can get the and then you have the efficiency loss too, that you end up. I think we assume early on that the putting on the carbon capture and sequestration increases the heat rate by about 20%, but that declines over time, so in the later years it's about 10%. But that still doesn't beat out nuclear. That's going to be a difficult, if some sort of greenhouse gas policy is proposed, it's going to make a lot of tough choices that people have to face, because if you don't want to build a lot of coal, are you willing to build a lot of nuclear? If not, you're not willing to build the nuclear. Are we going to put the infrastructure into building all the renewables? And it also introduces you a lot of uncertainty. The amount of renewables you might have to build nobody really knows what. I might be able to tell you what a good rough estimate of the next 10 or 15 gigawatts of biomass might cost, but if you get beyond that and you have to start displacing things and doing other things, those costs are really start to get uncertain. You would have to flip the fuel mix quite a bit to get to a fairly strict greenhouse gas policy, so it's going to introduce all kinds of uncertainties.
A couple of slides back, you had a slide with renewable generation alternatives. Did you factor in the impact of the transatlantic states?
We try to include that in our reference case, but it's a real struggle because I don't know if you've gone and tried to read the various states' programs.
Yeah, I've been involved.
Okay, I would encourage you, last year in our AEO we actually had, and we put out a report where we looked at trying to analyze the impacts of those. The problem in a lot of those states is that they're not clear-cut renewable portfolio standards. Many of them have all kinds of if clauses in them. You know, if the price is above this, you can buy your way out of it. If you build it in the state, we give you 2 credits. If you build this technology, we give you 2 credits. If you're not financially able or it's not competitive with other technologies, you don't have to do it. When you do all those things, it's really hard to assess what it's really going to do. We do have them in our reference case. We put ones in there. We think they're going, you know, how much they're going to build. But trying to assess them is a real struggle. We've been working in the model to actually try to directly model all those constraints and see what it would do. We're almost there, but not quite. And then that's the next study. And it's very hard because, as I say, there are enormous clauses in them. Some of them, for in California, they have a benefits fund. You know, they're going to collect money and pay for them. And so the limit is subject to how much money they have in the fund. Well, that fund is also used for a whole host of other things outside of just the renewables. So if the other program takes all the money, what are they going to do with that? I mean, so that's a difficult thing for us to figure out. But that is on our, we did look at that. We talked about a lot of those issues. And it was last year's AEO. And in the front of every AEO, we have a section what we call issues in focus, where we try to talk about some issues that are sort of people are dealing with and talking about that, you know, might be important to people. And that gets in last year's AEO in that section. And the nuclear discussion is in the year before in the issues in focus. Section talking about cost of nuclear plants. And just one last slide. Yeah, I put this at the end. I figured you'd have to wait so you know how to call me. Actually, I forgot to put it in and only added it this morning. Maybe there was a Freudian slip, not put your name on your presentation. That I thought later, maybe that was on purpose. But you certainly can contact me and I will try and help you. Well, we have run, you know, I honestly don't, you know, I hear that discussion a lot, and when I point out to people that when they, you know, they think, the worry everybody has is we've gone all gas. We certainly have gone all gas in recent capacity additions, but when I point out to them that coal actually grew more than gas in the last 15 years, they're sort of surprised, but that it did, and nuclear was only a little bit behind gas, so it's not that big. We have run, people have asked us at various times to run renewable portfolio standards. We've run carbon-free portfolio standards, where you said a certain amount of so you include in that nuclear and fossil plants with sequestration. I forgot to mention about these RPSs. Some of those RPSs allow certain fossil technologies too, so that was a hard thing. If you do fuel cells or do something else, they allow it. We've run a nuclear portfolio standard too, where people asked us to look at that. If you said you want to keep a certain share nuclear, and so some of those are available on our website also. But I've never looked at one where they've set diversity targets or anything like that. Yeah.
Basically a trade-off between nuclear and coal. And
Well, but coal and nuclear are critical baseload technologies. You're not going to build a, you're not going to spend, $2 or $3 billion on a plant that you're not going to plan to run, almost 24/7. Your gas is in your intermediate area. They're cheap to build, and if you don't run them all that much, that's not that expensive. But so what we see, if nuclear is successful, we would see a lot less coal in our forecast. Some less gas. I'm not going to say it's 100%. There'll be regions where it offsets gas too, but not that, not as much. We got to remember, if you knock that coal down, then the coal price will be lower, and then the coal price will be more competitive with gas at the intermediate. So you end up with sort of, they sort of play off each other. All of those, every one of those forces come into play. I remember yesterday when I was listening to the discussion about, trying to incentivize transmission. And, this seems unrelated, but when I hear those sort of things, I get worried, because why give something a different, make something more competitive than the other? Then you tend to mess up the mix. In all these markets, all of these options are possible. You could increase your transmission capacity, so you could bring in more power from somewhere else. You could do some local demand side management. You could do different fuels. All of those are viable. I think you're going to have to sell them. Interesting thing about it, you said it was a CFB, a circulating fluidized bed. They can burn biomass. and it'd be pretty hard to get take an awful lot of biomass to fuel a 270 megawatt plant. You'd have to collect it from probably a pretty broad area to make that work, but you certainly could mix the biomass with the coal in a CFB.
I understand you say that the capacity factor of the base load plants is still less than 60%.
No. It was in 1990, the coal plants were about 59% and the nuclear were about 66. Right now, the nuclears are right around 90 nationwide. And the coal plants, I think they're right around 71, 72. And I think they can go considerably higher. If you look at the summer months, I think most of this is demand curtailed. In other words, in the spring and fall, you just don't have enough demand to run them full out. And so you don't. But if you look, it's July through, say, September, you'll see nationwide that the coal plant capacity factors are right around 80%. When they have the demand, they run them even more. And so we expect, as the demand curve keeps pushing up, that the capacity factor of those existing coal plants will continue to push up and probably get somewhere around 80. Then they'll some of the older ones would probably run into problems trying to run any harder than that.
Are there any new innovative ideas?
I'm an economist, and so economists love real-time pricing as a panacea for lots of things. And it certainly is among the most talked about and discussed topics around the country. It's not something we have addressed in any sense, but it's certainly a big issue on the demand side. Mm-hmm.
Just an observation. Thank you. saving stuff really.
It's not going to do your base load, yeah.
That's really a different layer in the strata. The conservation is really a piece of that. You actually might have to.
Right, if you had conservation, you know, you also got to think of the time frame of when you need this capacity. If you were going to do some sort of incentive program to get people to turn over the stock of their existing appliances and things like that, that's going to take a while. These, even your refrigerators and air conditioners and things like that last 10 to 15 years. So if you were, you know, next week to start a program that gave them an incentive, it's going to take 10 or 15 years to really turn it over. And so what's the, if you need that plant in 3 years, yeah. Anything else? Well, that's all I have. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.